You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 389, Revelation 15 and 16. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Mike.
Yes.
How you feeling, man? How you feeling?
I'm a little tired, for those who are just tuning in. This is the first episode we're recording after my cancer diagnosis that, we put out on social media. So, yeah, as you listen, you'll probably hear that, I'll sound a little more tired because I am. I mean, the immediate issue is dehydration. So we're still dealing with that, but, there's no reason that we can't, keep going on the podcast, especially, as much as I love the book of Revelation. Let's not let something like cancer, be a deterrent, to me continuing in the book of Revelation. Wouldn't want that to happen.
No, absolutely not. Well, I mean, you sound good, so that's good. And, I think,
you must have some sort of filter on the other end, because I can feel it. I don't feel normal as far as energy level, but hey, if you make me sound good, that's good. How to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, words fall short, on anything that I can say, but, just thousands of people out there commenting on social media, and you're loved, and we're so thankful for your service for the kingdom and all you've done and still doing and going to do. And I'm honored to be here with you doing it for the last 7 years. And we're with you.
I mean, I know that I can obviously see that and tell it, and there are people, sending me, I'll get, some text messages, but people are putting mostly, responses on social media, and an email now and then. But I had my original pastor, who we had on one of the years at SBL, he's cycling through Jacksonville for their anniversary. So I'm gonna get to see him shortly in a couple of weeks. And I told him, his name's Dave, Dave Burgraff. He used to pastor in Lebanon where I grew up, but he's in Charlotte now. I said, I am by no means afraid to die. Because that's like Hebrews 2, that's your introduction to the council. I said, but if I do, I'm going to feel terribly cheated. and I actually have these, conversations, I guess, these conversations with God. It's like, this just doesn't make any sense at all. There's so much to do. I've got this whole list of things. I even have a spreadsheet. Here's my Excel spreadsheet of the things I should be doing. So I just said to Dave, I said, I am just going to feel terribly cheated. Like, because I don't know if it's a guy thing. I don't know if it's a Pennsylvania Dutch thing. But it's like, as good as I know the other will be, it's like, I don't feel like I've done my job. And, I just grew up in it. I grew up in a household and an environment where that's just, drilled into you. It's the whole work ethic thing. It's, you're not done until you're actually done. Don't come home until you're done. It's just this sort of mentality that, if you're raised in it, you never lose it. So that's kind of the situation I'm in. It's like, I just can't imagine not being able to, complete this or that task. So like I said, I would, sounds really goofy, but I would feel terribly cheated. that's just the way I'm looking at it.
We appreciate you continuing the podcast, even though we know you're tired. It means a lot to us. And again, words fall short, but we're there with you and Drina and your family, and we appreciate them sparing you to spend time with us. So again.
Oh yeah. And they're, Drina's doing a great job. So it's, basically having I mean, it's not like I'm bedridden or anything like that. I'm just sitting here at my desk. But, you know, there's a lot of mechanics and a lot of logistics, you know, to do with the intravenous stuff and the constant phone calls and going back and forth with doctor. I mean, she's doing all that. So she's essentially she's the boss.
Well, I'm glad she's doing that. You know, tell her thank
you. And I need it.
Yeah, tell her thank you for us so you can spend time with us doing this. So it's duly noted and appreciated. So be sure she knows that. And Drini, if you're listening, thank you. But
she'll probably give it a listen.
Well, Mike, I'm going to switch gears to some happy news because on Sunday, I got to baptize both my kids. So Jax and Jenna are baptized now. So that was a very proud father moment for me. So a little good news there. And
yeah, it's cool.
It's good stuff. Yeah, absolutely. And also, Abilene Wiley Little League made it to Williamsport, Pennsylvania for the World Series. In baseball, Little League baseball, right. Mike.
I thought you didn't care about baseball.
Well, I do because these kids are my son's age. They played baseball with them, so I like to take some credit that I taught them all they know in T-ball because I was a coach for a lot of them. So
run that way, not the other way.
Mike, I taught them important things like when they're 4 and 5 playing T-ball, like not how to eat the dirt and don't play with the dirt, stand up, things like that. So those are important things that you carry on in Little League.
Gentlemen, this is a baseball.
look at the batter or you're going to get hit. They're all would be bunched up at the pitcher mound. And it was like herding cats because they would just scatter playing the dirt and stuff like that. But now here they are 12 years old.
I remember doing that.
Going to the World Series.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Yeah, I remember doing that with Calvin. Every time the ball hits the bat, it's a home run because they just keep running.
Yeah, right. You know, nobody picks the
kids
ball
keep
up.
Throwing the ball somewhere.
Yeah,
you know, it's just every hit's a home run.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. That's good stuff. Well, I just want.
Did you watch the Field of Dreams game?
No, of course there's not. It's baseball. I'm not gonna watch that. I saw it though. I mean, don't get me wrong. I saw the highlights. How awesome is that?
All right. Yeah, it was cool. That's Ron Johnson's favorite movie.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of people's favorite movie. I mean, that movie's flawless. It's a great movie.
Yeah. I watched a lot of it. So I didn't see the end, unfortunately, though, live. I mean, I saw the walk-off on the replay. I just thought the Yankees were toast, you know, in the top of the ninth, but that was wrong. So I missed that part, but I saw most of it.
No, I'm head. You know, I'm starting Hard Knocks with Dallas Cowboys, so you know, that's where my head's at. Seeing how Dak is going to be this year, I'm watching.
Yeah, well, we got the fantasy league coming up too. So
yeah, I'm ready.
I will be there for that, unless I'm like unconscious or something. But
yeah,
you know, well, I plan to be at the draft.
Your draft won't be any different. So your team's going down regardless.
Sure.
All right, Mike. Well,
now we've covered the sports gamut now. And it's like, oh, yeah, everything's normal here. Hey, talking about stuff we don't care about.
Exactly. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to Abilene Wiley Little League team. So good luck, guys. And on some good news there, Mike. But all right. Well, we've got two chapters to cover today in Revelation.
Yeah. Revelation 15 and 16, because there's a lot of overlap here. And to some extent, there's been overlap with parts of both chapters in earlier chapters. So it's workable to take these two in tandem. And, you know, they cover the seven bowl judgments, you know, just generally anyway. So let's just jump in here a little bit. I'm going to go to Revelation 15. I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but just enough to get us started here. Revelation 15 is pretty short. I'll read that and then talk a little bit about chapter 15, and then we'll jump into 16. So, again, reading ESV, Revelation 15 says, "Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last. For with them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name, standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, "Great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." After this, I looked, and the sanctuary of the tent of witness in heaven was opened. And out of the sanctuary came the seven angels with the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen, with golden sashes around their chests. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls, full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the sanctuary was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no one could enter the sanctuary until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished. So that's Revelation 15, again, pretty short. And it opens with these seven angels who are going to unleash seven plagues, the bowl judgments. And we see these seven angels later, of course, in chapter 16. That's when we're going to get the actual bowl judgments spelled out. We also get a reference to them in 17:1 because, you know, the last bowl judgment is going to, you know, well, all the bowl judgments, but especially the last, is going to set up the fall of Babylon. And so we again get a reference to these seven angels in chapter 17, because chapter 17 and 18 really deal with the fall of Babylon. So we have seven angels. Again, we've seen this number of angels before, and like I just said, we'll see it again. What I want to focus on, though, is since we've covered a lot of the seven angel territory, is the sea of glass. Let's just start there. This is actually an Old Testament allusion, even though you would wonder, well, where have I seen a sea of glass before, other than, you know, maybe the book of Revelation, you know, certain language that lends itself to that. Beale and McDonough summarize it this way. They say, "The sight of what appeared to be like a sea of glass, like crystal, could include allusion to the reflection of the laver in Solomon's temple and the heavenly splendor of God's holy separateness. But uppermost in mind is the heavenly analog to the Red Sea in connection with the new Exodus. This identification is confirmed beyond doubt by the following mention of the new Song of Moses, which is the latter-day counterpart of Moses' song recounted in Exodus 15. The Exodus atmosphere is discernible through the prior mention of plagues," that's chapter 15, verse 1, "which clearly are modeled after the plagues of Egypt," and we're going to see that in chapter 16, "and by the subsequent mention of the tabernacle of testimony in verse 5. The first exodus out of Egypt and out from under Pharaoh's tyrannical power will be recapitulated by divine design in a final end-time exodus of God's people out from under the tyrannical oppression and rule of the beast over the world." So that's a paragraph of summary. You know, I think it's a pretty good summary, because since it's going to be very clear that you have Exodus plague imagery with the bowls, and you've got the Song of Moses specifically mentioned, it, you know, what we have here with, you know, the sea language, again, is analogous to the deliverance of the Red Sea. So we have the deliverance of the Red Sea back in the Old Testament, where God's people are delivered from, at the time, what was the primary chaos agent of the Old Testament? Ancient Egypt, because ancient Egypt was, again, holding God's people hostage in Egypt. They, of course, Pharaoh eventually tries to exterminate them. All that serves an analogy for John when it comes to beasts. Now, the beast is bigger and wider and badder and all those things. But again, he sees an analogy to the beast, and specifically, you know, he's going to analogize the beast not only to Egypt here, but we've already seen him do it, and we're going to see him do it. He's going to analogize it to Babylon. Babylon becomes, after Egypt, the primary chaos agent, the primary anti-Eden agent, the primary threat to the existence of the people of God and the survival of the covenants, really the restoration of Eden. Babylon is the primary threat to that as the Old Testament, you know, comes to a close, which is why, again, here, as John's looking, you know, forward, you know, into what awaits the church, the looming threat and darkness, he's going to portray that threat and the beast and his power with Babel, and with Egypt. I mean, it makes sense. This is how you communicate the idea, not only the idea of who they are, but what God is going to do and who's actually going to win here. Now, there are other Old Testament allusions to the sea and the crystal, you know, language, the sea of glass, that kind of thing. Ezekiel 1:21 is probably the more obvious in terms of the specific language, where you have the firmament in Ezekiel 1:21, which is the crystal platform for God's throne. Yeah, and that's important because we have to remember what the context for Revelation 15 is. This is still part of that divine council meeting that we were launched into in Revelation 4 and 5, you know, where the judgments of God and the Lamb are going to be described and meted out. All of this is taking place, again, in the divine council context. And so, of course, we would get this image associated with the throne of God, because in Ezekiel 1, we have the same image with God's throne, you know, the wheels and the fire, and you get the firmament again with the cherubim and all this. And we've seen all of these elements from Ezekiel 1 elsewhere in the book of Revelation, Revelation 4 and 5 being most prominent. So we shouldn't be surprised to see it picked up again here, sort of as a kind of as a cue for readers, again, to reorient ourselves back into the actual scene where this is taking place. So Beal observes that, but he also loops in Daniel 7 along with Ezekiel 1 and Exodus 15 in his comments about the sea of glass mentioned in Revelation 4:6. So if we go back and look at, you know, what he said there, he's going to describe the relationship of this scene and this language to the divine council decision of Daniel 7, specifically 7:10, and that involves the judgment of the fourth beast, whose body was given to be burnt with fire, and that's Daniel 7:11. So Beal writes, the sea is also associated with the idea of evil, and that's familiar to us. Caird, who was a well-known New Testament scholar, has argued that here it connotes cosmic evil, since it often has such nuance in the Old Testament, and sometimes elsewhere in Revelation. And he notes Revelation 13:1, 21:1, and especially 15:2. As well as the abyss in 11:7. This speculation receives support from the modeling of these chapters on Daniel 7, since the sea as a picture of the beast's origin is a significant feature in Daniel 7. And the scenes of Daniel 7 and Ezekiel 1, of course, have integral literary links. The former is usually seen as dependent on the latter. The portrayal of the Red Sea in the Old Testament as the abode of the evil sea monster, again, this is Leviathan imagery, confirms that this setting is also included in John's thought. And he notes, you know, he recommends comparing Isaiah 51, 9 through 11 and Psalm 74, 12 through 15 and Ezekiel 32, 2. Psalm 74 is one that we've referenced here on the podcast a number of times about Leviathan imagery that's tied to the crossing of the Red Sea. So Beal continues, in view of the Daniel and Exodus imagery, there is then a hint that John sees the chaotic powers of the sea as calmed by divine sovereignty. Revelation 5:5 and following reveals that Christ's overcoming through his death and resurrection is what defeated the power of evil and so calmed Satan's watery, tumultuous abode, again, the abyss. Revelation 4:6 gives a picture of the stilling of the hellish waters from the heavenly perspective, though the devil displays his wrath even more furiously on earth because he has been decisively defeated in heaven. That's Revelation 12, he gives a side nod to. When John later says that there is no longer any sea, again, the sea is no more, Revelation 21:1, he means that all evil on the earth will not only be defeated but also eradicated when Christ's kingdom is established consummately on earth. In fact, the sea of glass like crystal before the throne in 4:6 may be an intentional contrast with a river, with the phrase, a river of the water of life clear as crystal coming from the throne in Revelation 22:1. So what Beal is suggesting here is that the sea here might be both a metaphor or a symbol of satanic evil, you know, the power of the beast, because he comes from the sea and all these other allusions here. But also it's still the throne of God, because God is the victor over chaos. So he's saying it's a symbol or an image that can do double duty. Both, again, the thing that's the threat, the symbol of the threat and the origin of the beast, but also just like back in the Old Testament, the Red Sea was, I mean, when they're standing there at the Red Sea, they're thinking we're going to die. And the sea is a metaphor for chaos. But God subdues, divides, parts the waters. He is in control. He dominates chaos at the Exodus event. And so that would be what John is trying to convey here, that despite all the stuff that he said about the beast up to this point and the terribleness of what's going on earth, you know, it's the Lord that's going to dominate the beast. The Lord is going to win the day. So again, he's using this imagery to convey these thoughts. So again, the point for Revelation 15 in these observations from Beale and others is that you have God's throne resting atop, you know, the sea of glass. Again, if it is tied to Ezekiel 1, and it's pretty hard to see how it couldn't be. Just like Ezekiel 1 was a declaration of God's sovereignty. Yeah, we're sitting here in Babylon, but you know, you got the cherubim with the four faces, the four cardinal points of the zodiac, and you know, God is still king over time and history, you know, the movement of time, the epochs of time. He knows where history is going. He's in control of it. All these things are again brought to bear in Revelation 15 as we lead up to the final set of seven judgments, the bowl judgments, and the collapse, the defeat of the beast, you know, and his empire. So if we move to let's move to verses 5-8, Revelation 15. We have just a few comments here. The attire of the angels, again, how they're dressed, is obviously drawn from Levitical priestly garments. You know, we could see that from Ezekiel 9:2-3, Ezekiel 9:11, Ezekiel 10:2, Daniel 10:5, Daniel 12:6-7. And we, you know, just to harken back to earlier episodes, there was this notion about how maybe the 144,000, because of the way they're dressed, I mean, you know, Levitically, and also the comment that have not defiled themselves with women, maybe they are sort of a priestly class that symbolically represents the antithesis of the watchers, you know, and again, the chaos they're going to spawn on earth at their release, you know, from the abyss. So some of that could be in play here too. So we don't want to forget that. Bulls, moving on from the clothes, bulls are also used in the Old Testament inside the sanctuary, okay, inside the tabernacle and the temple. And On, in his Revelation commentary, has a few brief comments about this. He says, the word phiale, usually translated bowl, must be understood as a cultic utensil. In other words, it's an object used in ritual service, priestly service. And he says, it should therefore be translated bowl used in offerings. And he references BDAG, you know, the main lexicon for that idea. So because if translators chose to do that, it would preserve the, again, the ritual feel to it as opposed to just bowl. Because, you know, we think of cereal bowls or something, you know, just, but it's a little more specific in that in context. And Owen says, these libation bowls are mentioned 12 times in Revelation. I'm not going to give you the grocery list. You could look that up and concord it. But they're mentioned a lot. And again, a lot of the stuff, a lot of the places, really up to Revelation 21:9 in the list that Owen gives of these 12 times, most of them are going to be in passages that have the heavenly tabernacle, i.e. the throne of God, i.e. the divine council throne room in view. So again, the ritual angle is definitely worth pursuing and observing. So the bowls then are cast as ritual objects. You know, what were they used for? Again, if you use the Old Testament analogy, the bowls there were probably used to carry out the ashes and fat of sacrifices from sacred space. And if that's the case, the symbolism would likely be that the earth is about to be purified by removing defilement. The earth is going to be sanctified. It's going to be made ready for the reoccupation of the Messiah, because what follows is the decimation of the beast. And the next image we run into is the sanctuary filling with smoke. This is going to bring us to the end of chapter 15. And that reinforces this, again, Levitical ritual, you know, idea for these other vessels, these other instruments. Beale and McDonough note this. They say God's presence in the temple is highlighted as it is, quote, filled with the smoke of God's glory and from his power, unquote, which is language that you'll find also in Exodus 40, verses 34 and 35, 1 Kings 8, the prayer for the temple that Solomon builds, 1 Kings 8, 10 through 11, 2 Chronicles 5, 13, Isaiah 6, 1 and 4, especially in the Septuagint. Again, those references, especially in the Septuagint. And they continue by saying, the description may be a collective echo of similar Old Testament descriptions of God's presence in the earthly temple, though the focus may be more on Ezekiel 10, 2 and 2 through 4, where an angelic being, quote, clothed with linen, unquote, stands close to the four cherubim in the heavenly temple, and, quote, the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord, unquote. The Ezekiel 10 scene is an introduction to an announcement of judgment, which brings it even closer to the function of the similar vision in Revelation 15, so that the former becomes analogous to the latter. Again, you've still got this, the judgment context. You've got the purification of not the heavenly tabernacle temple here, but the earth. Again, the idea being conveyed by the priestly garments, the bowls. Again, ritual service. The earth is being prepared for the reoccupation of the Messiah. In other words, it's being prepared to once again become sacred space. We're removing defilement. We're going to destroy the beast and move on from there. And let's jump into Revelation 16 from this point. Here's where we actually get the seven bowls described. So 15 is the setup. 16 is where we get them described. In the first three bowls, I'm going to read Revelation 16, 1 through 7, and we'll just jump in there. So that, again, the context for all this is the divine council meeting that began in Revelation 4 and 5. And the slain and risen Lamb of chapter 5 is the revealer and the dispenser of the judgments through the authority of the enthroned Father. So Revelation 16, 1 says this. Starting there, then I heard a loud voice from the temple telling the seven angels, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God. So the first angel went and poured out his bowl on the earth, and harmful and painful sores came upon the people, who bore the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. The second angel poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became like the blood of a corpse, and every living thing died that was in the sea. The third angel poured out his blood into the rivers and the springs of water, and they became blood. And I heard the angel in charge of the waters say, just are you, O Holy One, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. It is what they deserve. And I heard the altar saying, yes, Lord God the Almighty, true and just are your judgments. Now that's Revelation 16, 1 through 7 gets us into the first three of these. And as was the case way back, not way back, but somewhat way back, with the first trumpet judgment, the first bowl judgment targets the earth. So there's a parallel there. And those afflicted are those having the mark of the beast. Now, the immediate Old Testament point of reference is the League of Bulls. This is Exodus 9, 9 through. There's an ironic reversal here. If you remember the plague back then, again, the Egyptians are the one that get the plague of boils. Here we have those being afflicted are the ones that take the mark of the beast. And so the reversal here is those who take the idolatrous mark of the beast are now marked with boils in God's judgment. So again, there's some irony here that you know, I'm sure John doesn't want readers to miss. But you took the mark, well, God's going to mark you. Here's the first mark. Remember these? You know, the boils from the Egyptian plague judgment. The second and third bowls take us back to the Nile. Obviously, when I read that, I'm sure that's what is popping up in your head. It takes us back to the Nile turning to blood, the initial plague on Egypt, which was Exodus 7, 14 through 25. And in his Revelation commentary, Beale has a good bit to say about this connection. I'm going to read you a good portion of it. It's all good stuff of, again, how the context is going to inform what's going on here. So he says, the second bowl's parallelism with the second trumpet, okay, we don't want to forget that again, Revelation 8, 8 and 9, is striking. The trumpet struck the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died. Likewise, the second bowl strikes the sea, and there came about blood as of a dead person, and every living thing died, the things in the sea. Both texts, he says, are based on Exodus 7:17-21, where Moses turns the Nile into blood and the fish in it die, just like in Revelation 8:8-9, Revelation 16:3. Philo, Beale comments, was actually a commentator that extended the effect of the plague in Exodus 7 to include the death of people, which is not a detail you're going to get back in Exodus necessarily, but again, he fills in the gap in it, and he therefore sounds a lot like Revelation here. Beale continues and says, therefore, the second trumpet and the second bowl have to do with the same kind of judgment. The primary difference is the trumpet's partial effect and the bowl's total effect. Just as the world kingdom of Babylon was the object of the second trumpet's woe, so likewise the kingdom of Babylon throughout the world, together with that of the beast, is the object of the second bowl's affliction. Indeed, the bowls generally are linked to the judgment of Babylon, as implied from the connection of Revelation 14:8-10 with Revelation 15:7 and here in 16:1. The seventh bowl makes the link with Revelation 14:8-10 explicit, especially in Revelation 16:19. Here's what it says. Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. So the connection between this Exodus imagery and Babylon is very explicit. Beale goes on and says, the sea, as figurative for ungodly humanity, is not inconsistent with other uses of thalassa in the apocalypse, in the book of Revelation. It occurs 24 times. And many of those references are susceptible to such a symbolic interpretation. Beale actually thinks all of them are, except for Revelation 18:17, 19, and 21. Clearly, the many waters later in Revelation 17:1 are a picture of unbelievers throughout the earth, which is echoed in 17:15. Furthermore, Satan's standing, quote, on the sand of the sea in Revelation 12:18 may refer to his sovereignty over the wicked nations, since in Revelation 20:8, ungodly nations are, again, compared to the sand of the sea. The sea from which the beast of Revelation 13:1 emerges represents the mass of nations. This symbolic understanding of Revelation 16:3 is supported by the explicit figurative interpretation of the bloody rivers and springs of waters in verse 4 as God's judgment on the impious, you know, on unbelievers. So I'm going to just stop there. What Beale's trying to argue here, and I think, you know, does a good job, is that this language about the waters, when it refers to the waters being, you know, poisoned and polluted, you know, with the blood and stuff like that, it's a symbolic way of expressing those who take the mark of the beast, just like the, you know, the first bowl judgment, they're the ones that are afflicted. Well, the same people are afflicted here. It's not just an affliction of the literal waters, but as Beale's pointing out, some of this language, waters, sand of the sea itself, gets used elsewhere in the book for people, for the mass of nations opposed to God. Again, just think of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview here. The nations against Israel, okay, the nations under dominion, you know, of hostile supernatural forces. You know, here, you know, we have the beast, we have Satan. So what Beale is saying, again, is a lot of this, we don't want to over-literalize the language here. In fact, we want to look at how the language is used elsewhere in the book. And when you do that, it's used to people, which would make sense because people are being judged in the first bowl judgment. Why would we expect them to not be judged in the second and third bowl judgment? The target is people. It's not just dirt, water, grass. Okay. You know, it's people. It's the people who take the mark are going to be suffering the affliction. Just, you know, think back to the Exodus imagery and, you know, the connection is pretty obvious. So to pick up again, Beale, again, to make, you know, reiterate the point, he says, the understanding of blood in verse 3 as representing the suffering of the ungodly is warranted by the immediate context, and he refers to verses 2 and 8 through 11, and by the use of blood, The Greek term is haima. Elsewhere in Revelation to refer, without exception, to the suffering of the wicked or of Christ and the saints. So he has a long grocery list of references to blood here that going to refer to the suffering of the wicked, which in context makes sense because they're the ones that are the targets of the bowl judgments. So again, I think the specific citation in Revelation 16:6, you know, when we hit this this section here, let me just reiterate it. Just are you, O Holy One, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments, for they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, and it's what they deserve, so on and so forth. That is a citation of Psalm 79:3, and also, let me just go to Psalm 79:3 here. It's a few verses in Psalm 79. Psalm 79:3, if you go up to the beginning of the psalm, a psalm of Asaph, O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have laid Jerusalem in ruins. Obviously, this is a post-Nebuchadnezzar, post-Babylon psalm. They have given the bodies of your servants to the birds of the heavens for food, the flesh of your faithful to the beasts of the earth. They have poured out their blood like water. This is verse 3. All around Jerusalem, there was no one to bury them. You keep going down to verse 10. Why should the nations say, where is their God? Let the avenging of the outpoured blood of your servants be known among the nations before our eyes. Okay, so you have this nation talk in the psalm that John quotes in Revelation 16:6 about blood. Okay, so what Beale is arguing that the symbolism here, again, is once again designed to inform readers who sort of have these cross references in their heads. It's designed to inform readers that the judgment here is about those who take the mark of the beast. They are going to, ironically, have the same thing happen to them that way back in the Old Testament, Babylon did to God's people in Psalm 79. So now it's going to happen to them. Things are going to come full circle. It is an intended reversal strategy that John has here, again, to help the reader see that what he's describing is the defeat of the ultimate chaos agent, Babylon. And this is the natural touch point in the Old Testament for what he's saying here, you know, and what he wants us, you know, to get across to his readers. You know, I would also want to throw in here, Beale doesn't mention it. Let me just look it up here. Just popped into my head. Deuteronomy 32, not verse 8, but the other Dead Sea Scroll text that, you know, is affected or affects Deuteronomy 32 is verse 43. And ESV, I'm going to read again because it follows, just like it does in verse 8, it follows the Dead Sea Scrolls here. It says this, "Rejoice with him, O heavens." You could translate it, "O heavenly ones. Bow down to him, all gods." So it starts out where the ones who are going to be rejoicing are the ones, members of the heavenly host, who are loyal to God. And they are commanded, the gods of the nations. This is Deuteronomy 32, okay? The gods of the nations are commanded to bow down to God and his counsel, okay? For he avenges, here's the rest of the verse, "For he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land." Okay, that verse, Deuteronomy 32:43, I'm a little surprised that Beale doesn't mention it. That verse is a microcosm of what Beale has been saying in his commentary about this chapter, about these first three bowl judgments. It's the judgment of the nations. Those who are under dominion of the beast are the nations. They are all the people who are not the people of God. And this is the eschatological day of the Lord. This is, you know, all of this judgment stuff. This is the day of the Lord. All this stuff's going to be a precursor to the return of the Messiah, to the return of Jesus. And this is the time when the gods are destroyed. So, you know, when we have all this talk about the nations being the target of these judgments, yes, it refers to people who have taken the mark. But even more significantly, it refers to the beast, you know, it's all leading up to chapter 17 and 18, where the beast himself is destroyed. And of course, that's going to lead to the destruction of Satan himself. You know, all of this stuff. Okay, the whole system, both cosmic and earthly, this is where it's going to come to an end. And Deuteronomy 32, 43 really, I think, encapsulates that very nicely. Revelation 16, 8 through 16, that's the next three bowls. So numbers 4, 5, and 6. And really, let's just read that, and we may just read through the end of the chapter here, but we've got here, the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and it was allowed to scorch people with fire. They were scorched by the fierce heat, and they cursed the name of God, who had power over these plagues. They did not repent and give him glory. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. People gnawed their tongues in anguish and cursed the God of heaven for their pain and sores. They did not repent of their deeds. The sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are demonic spirits performing signs, who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that he may not go about naked and be seen exposed. And they assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon, or Har-Mageddon in Greek. So you have the next three bowl judgments. Bowl 4 begins in verse 8. And the command here, kind of like verse 17, later on, let me just jump to verse 17, because that's going to be basically the end of the chapter. So let's just go back there. So Revelation 16, 17, this is where the seventh bowl starts up. This says, the seventh angel, poured out his bowl into the air. So we have that phrase, the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. We've got back in verse 8, the fourth angel pouring out his bowl on the sun. And this has drawn interest from commentators because it appears contradictory to Revelation 16, verse 1, the verse that starts out this whole series of bowl judgments, which says, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God. So how in the world can we be pouring out bowls on the sun and on the air? I mean, the bowls are supposed to be poured out on the earth. So commentators have noticed this. And on the most useful thing to say here, he notes that in Revelation 16, 8 and 17, that what John is really informing us of is that what is in view is the ancient conception of matter. So Owen writes this. In Revelation 16, 1, the bowl angels are commanded to pour out their libation bowls upon the earth. While this plague is not closely related to the others, it does result in the affliction of the four elements. Okay, this plague, he means the one here beginning in 16, 8 with the sun. It results in the affliction of one of the four elements. And this is going to go for 16, 17. What were the four elements of the conception of matter in the Hellenistic world? That everything was composed of earth, water, fire, and air. And so Owen is basically saying, this is why we get the language we do. It all concerns the earthly existence of people as they know it. And as they understand it and as they articulate it, that everything's made of earth, water, fire, and air. And so it doesn't matter that you get this verbiage in verse 8 and verse 17 that doesn't say earth. It says, you know, sun, you know, which is the source of heat, source of fire, and air in verse 17. It doesn't matter because it's just ancient elemental thinking. And I think he's really on the right track here. It makes good sense. So in other words, you know, and taking Beale's earlier comments about the symbolic nature of the language just generally to heart, what is described here in all the bowls, even these the ones that have this odd wording, is a judgment of all the earth in its most basic elemental sense. And the goal is to express totality. Okay, all the elements of the earth are affected. And by extension, this is the ancient writer's way of describing that all, not just some or most, all of the followers of the beast will be judged, every one of them, no matter where they are on the earth. The picture is thus not one of literal, again, overly literal cosmic upheavals that have to be dodged by believers. Because, you know, let's be honest, when you get into sort of popular commentary reading of Revelation, these are the kind of passages where, oh, it must be a supernova. Oh, it must be a, you know, some kind of plague or a virus or, you know, something like that. Well, if the whole point of the bulls is the judgment of those who have taken the mark, okay, if these judgments are literal, then they're going to affect believers. Here's the point. The believers are under the sun too. It's the same sun that shines on a believer as an unbeliever. Believers are under the sun too. So if this is literal, they'd be included. Believers breathe air too. So if this was literal, if we're supposed to read this literally as some kind of poisoning of the air, well, believers would be affected by that too, unless they've got gills or something. Everybody's wearing a space helmet. You know, the literal interpretations here that again are very common in popular commentaries and, you know, on the internet, sort of conspiratorial kind of thinking. They just don't work here, because if you're going to keep the bulls in context about being directed toward all of the people who have taken the mark of the beast, these can't be literal judgments of the literal sun and air, because believers are under the same sun and they breathe the same air. So this is, again, part of why Beale and other commentators on, you know, say that the language here is meant to express elemental totality, with the goal being to communicate the idea that every person who's taken the mark of the beast, no matter where they are, is going to be judged. God isn't going to miss any of them. None of them are getting away. So it's trying to express totality, but over a very specific target audience, if you will, and that is those who've taken the mark. Another irony we get here is that those who have taken the name of the beast curse the name of God, who is now judging them. It's a nice touch. Again, it brings that, the whole thing about the mark of the beast is really about bearing the name that we talked about earlier when we talked about 666. So again, some of these ideas are just getting picked up and you know, they become threads through the whole description. The fifth bowl, you know, we get some questions there. What is the throne of the beast? Okay, in Revelation 16:10, we read here, the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. So obviously throne and kingdom are used in parallel there. People gnawed their tongues in anguish and cursed the God of heaven for their pain and sores and did not repent. So what do we make of this? The throne of the beast is not likely a specific place. Nothing in the other judgments suggests this, again, because we're dealing with totality. More likely, and this is Beale's thought, more likely the throne represents the beast's sovereignty over his entire realm. Therefore, the bowl affects the beast's ability to rule anywhere and everywhere. So I'm paraphrasing Beale there. The judgment, of course, itself reminds us of the plague of darkness. Back in Egypt, that was number 9 in the Exodus plagues, Exodus 10, 21 through 29. And it also reminds us of the fourth trumpet plague back in Revelation 8, 12, where the sun, moon, and stars were partially obliterated. Now, as Ahn notes, this is, quote, a typical apocalyptic event. And he cites a bunch of Old Testament passages, Isaiah 13:10, Joel 2:10, Joel 3:15, Amos 8:9, Habakkuk 3:11, bunch of Second Temple literature. You know, this is very typical of Day of the Lord apocalyptic description. And he also adds that darkness is a symbol of judgment, you know, in other places. He points out 1 Samuel 2:9, Amos 5:20, which is one of those passages that has the day of Yahweh will be darkness and not light. Joel 2:2 is another, Zephaniah 1:15. So again, it's Day of the Lord imagery from the Old Testament drawn into, you know, what we're reading here with the fifth bowl. And Ahn also notes that, quote, it is not immediately evident why the plague of darkness should inflict pain on people who are part of the kingdom of the beast. Okay, well, that's nice. He notes the problem, but he doesn't offer any solution. Beale takes this as metaphorical, so I'm going to read you what he has here, and he relates it to the Egyptians. He says, this pain, you know, like, why would darkness cause pain? Okay. This pain is metaphorical for all ordained events designed to remind the ungodly that their persecution and idolatry are vain. And it indicates their separation from God. Let me just jump in here, because God is the source of light, okay, in biblical thought. Back to Beale. As with the Egyptians, this darkness induces anguish, figuratively expressed by the phrase, they gnawed their tongues because of the pain. God causes all who follow the beast to have times of anguish and horror when they realize that they are in spiritual darkness, and they are separated from God, and that eternal darkness awaits them. The temporal judgment here is a precursor to the final judgment, when unbelievers will be, quote, cast into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's Matthew 8:12, 22:13, and 25:30. That's the end of the Beale quote. Isn't that interesting? You know, we have New Testament passages that associate darkness with pain. And it's really referring in the Gospels, again, to the place of eternal separation from God. And so that's what Beale is playing off here to explain the language of this bull. And I think it's reasonable. Revelation 16:12-21, again, the sixth bowl, and this takes us to the end of the chapter, the seventh bowl. Let me just go back here, because we ended with the Armageddon verse. The seventh bowl, this is verse 17 now, the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, it is done. And there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, a great earthquake such as there had never been since man was on the earth, so great was that earthquake. And the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away. No mountains were to be found. Great hailstones, about 100 pounds each, fell from the heaven on people. And they cursed God for the plague of the hail, because the plague was so severe. So, you know, there's a lot here that, again, dovetails into the preceding bowls and then adds a specific element of its own, the hail. And I bring that up because there are some commentators who sort of want to merge these things, but we'll get to that in a moment before we wrap up here, or as we wrap up. So I would say that just in regard to the sixth and seventh bowls, just like the other ones, they're clear references back to Babylon. We have the river Euphrates mentioned. Like, how clear is that to Babylon? And the kings of the East. Okay, well, who are the kings of the East to somebody living in John's day? I got news for you. It's not China. The kings of the East, think, where is Israel? Where is Canaan? Now, what's East? Look East. It's Babylon. Okay, it's the Tigris and the Euphrates. It's Babylon. It's the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians. Okay, this would be obvious, again, to anyone living at the time, acquainted with their geography. And frankly, the rest of these judgments, the first layer of seven, the second layer of seven, here we're in the third layer of seven, and it's all pointing to Babylon as the chief metaphor for the ultimate chaos agent, okay, in this case, in John's writing, the beast and his whole system. So the sixth bowl, again, makes this abundantly clear. You've got this language referring back to Babylon very clearly. In some sense, in some respects, it is like the last judgment due to its overlap with the seven bowl, because the seventh bowl could be read as a climactic summary, some commentators do. However, the seventh bowl does have a distinctive element of hail, which again takes us back to the Exodus plagues on Egypt. So I'm content to have them be a discrete six and seven, you know, bowls and judgments. But you'll see this sort of merging in other commentators. The sixth bowl further represents a striking parallel to the sixth trumpet. So we have a symmetry there. Both feature the great river Euphrates as the sixth element in the respective sequence. And it's Revelation 9:14 compared to 16:12. In Revelation 16:19, Babylon is specifically noted again as the point of orientation. Kings of the East. You know, look at what's happening here. These kings of the East are the ones who are going to meet at the place which is in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. You know, for the whole Armageddon thing, you need to go back and look at Unseen Realm chapter 41. This is not Megiddo. This is Jerusalem. This is Mount Zion. This is where the final apocalyptic battle is going to take place. Harmageddon is not a reference to Megiddo for a number of reasons. Again, just go back and read the material in the book. Unseen Realm, Chapter 41. It's a reference to the Har Mored, which is the place of the Divine Council. So the forces of evil, the forces of Babylon, the primary chaos agent, and all his forces, the hordes that are associated with the East, which is Babylon, okay? All of the nations, they're going to march on Jerusalem, which is God's domain, the place of his council. It's God's cosmic mountain dwelling place, Jerusalem and Zion. And that is where we are going to find out and see how this all plays out. It's the final confrontation for all the marbles. And it takes place at and really over, and it's really about who will be most high. Who will sit on the throne of Zion? Who will occupy the throne of the cosmic mountain? Is Babylon going to overwhelm Jerusalem and Zion again? Or, and we know how the story ends, is everything going to be reversed from the way it was the first time? And of course, the answer is the latter. So after the Babel Rebellion, think of it this way. After the Babel Rebellion back in Genesis 11, and that judgment, you know, of the nations, assigning them to lesser members of the heavenly host, you know, out of which emerges the Deuteronomy 32 worldview with the princes, the supernatural princes over geographical nations and the principalities and the powers and all this stuff, okay? You know, after that event, after that is launched, that awful situation of the third rebellion in the primeval history, Genesis 1 through 11, after that occurs, in the flow of biblical history, Egypt emerged as the nation that was the central enemy. They are the face of chaos in the ensuing biblical story, because we have Abraham called, we've got Isaac born, we've got Jacob, Israel. Israel winds up down in Egypt, and they're almost exterminated. So Egypt emerges as the primary face of chaos, but it doesn't stay with them. Obviously, Babylon emerges again, as rightfully it that way, of the situation that was begun on its own doorstep, as it were. You know, Egypt gets displaced by Babylon in that role, and Babylon's status as the emblem of anti-Eden transcends that of Egypt, because it's Babylon, and Babylon succeeded where Egypt did not. Babylon conquered Jerusalem, destroyed it, destroyed the temple, sent the people of God into exile. Now, God used them. God is still behind this. It was a judgment for Israel's own idolatry. We understand that. But Babylon succeeds where Egypt did not, with the destruction of the nation of Israel and Zion via the exile. And all of this imagery, all of this back history connected specifically to Babylon is strewn throughout all of these judgments. They're not about Russia. They're not about Asia or China, okay? You have to think more transcendently. You have to think about just chaos in general. The forces of cosmic and human evil, humans that are aligned with cosmic evil in general, that is who the end time enemy is. The whole system, it's not tied to one geographical entity that we're familiar with. Okay, we don't want to use a single geographical entry or even a couple as filters through which to interpret Revelation, when none of that would have been in John's head. And he's trying to communicate the totality of the problem. And the best way you do that is Babylon, because of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview and the history of what happened to Zion before. So it's quite misguided, again, to try to pin the beast tail on some nation that we don't like today. I'm not saying we should like them, okay? But that misses the point. It's so much bigger than that. It's everything. It's the whole system. It's the whole world. Everything aligned against Christ and his people. So all of this sets the stage for the ultimate reversal, Revelation 17 and 18, the fall of Babylon. And that's what we'll get into as we keep going.
All right, Mike, it's interesting because we've actually stood at Megiddo with you talking about this exact thing and how it's not the location, but physically, visually.
Where's the mountain?
Yeah, visually standing there and seeing it, how it's kind of more of a valley.
Yep.
It's just amazing.
Yep. Where's the mountain?
Absolutely.
Where'd it go? Who moved it? Gosh. Well,
yeah, God did, I guess. But all right. Looking forward to the next two chapters. You know, we're getting close to wrapping up Revelation, so we're getting to the conclusion, and I'm looking forward to the next couple episodes, chapter 17 and 18. And also, Mike, I wanted to mention that just to make sure to clarify that, you know, we have canceled our conference. So I just wanted to throw that out there for listeners. And I want to ask our listeners for continual prayers for you, Mike, and your family. And we appreciate, again, all that you do. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.